Hello, everyone. Welcome to another of the six lectures being given by the Slade Professor of Fine Art for 2021. These lectures are an important tradition at the University of Oxford. John Ruskin was the first to give a series of public lectures on art in 1870, shortly after being appointed as the initial Slade Professor of Fine Art. Every year, a distinguished scholar is asked to follow in his footsteps. My name is Geoffrey Batchen, and I am Professor of the History of Art at the University of Oxford. It is my great pleasure to introduce this year's Slade Professor, Dr. Geraldine D. Dodds. Gerry Dodds is Harlequin Adair Darman Professor, Faculty of Art History at Sarah Lawrence College in the United States. Professor Dodds' scholarly work has centered on medieval Spanish and art and architecture, and especially on issues of transculturation and identity formation. Among her many publications are Arts of Intimacy, Christians, Jews, and Muslims in the Making of Castilian Culture, a renowned co-authored textbook. In addition to her other books, catalogues, and essays, Gerry has also curated a number of important exhibitions and made films to accompany them. In 2018, in recognition of her exceptional contributions to the dissemination of knowledge of Spanish history and culture, Professor Dodds was the recipient of the Cross of the Order of Civil Merit from the Government of Spain. We are honored that Professor Dodds accepted our invitation to deliver this year's Slade Professor of Fine Art lectures, and I now happily hand over the microphone to her.
Thank you so much, Professor Batchen. Thank you for your kind words. My abiding thanks to the Committee for Slade Lectures for this honor, for the support of the Department of Art History, and to Holly Knights and the amazing Torch team. So, by the late 11th century, the headlands of the Duero River, over which the Umayyad fortress of Gormaz still loomed, had for a long time been a frontier, not only between polities ruled by Christians and Muslims, but also those between Christian kings aided by their Muslim allies. From this ambivalent landscape emerged the hermitage of San Baudelio de Berlanga. It likely marked the possession of this frontier after it was claimed by King Alfonso VI of León and Castile, shortly after he took the great city of Toledo during the last quarter of the 11th century. Nestled in an austere landscape, this monastic oratory looked for all the world like a bunker that had weathered so many changes in hegemony. Its interior, however, is another thing altogether. Beneath 12th century paintings, its architectural structure is carbon dated to the late 11th century, and it is, in its basic construction technique, part of local Romanesque tradition. But that vault and those arches have given some scholars pause, so Berlanga is still often called Mozarabic. The term seems to survive as an explanation for the use of a horseshoe arch in the late 11th century into the temporal domain of Romanesque. The term Mozarabic becomes something like a taxonomic strategy to assuage the anxiety caused by this departure from a semicircular classicizing arch form in a building beyond the wilds of the transcultural 10th century. And then it's not just the horseshoe arch that presents a challenge. There are only the most rudimentary pretensions to orders at San Baudelio, and within its grand arching rib vault is another miniature version, this one quite close to examples at Toledo, such as the little mosque of Ibn Hadidi, which became the Church of Santa Cruz, and is also tucked away in a fashion, as that one was, or to the oratory from the Taifa Palace in Toledo, which about this time became the Palace of Alfonso VI, as the Castilian king took Toledo, something about which we spoke in the first lecture. This has led to an insistence on Muslim or Mozarabic artisans as an explanation for this architecture, though Isidro Bango places the vaulting within local Sorian tradition. And then it also has a tribune with a separate entrance for laity and a second altar, part of Cluniac reforms likely introduced by a new bishop brought from the Diocese of Osma to France. brought to the Diocese of Osma from France for that purpose. The issue here is not whether or not there might have been Andalusi Christian or local Muslims in Berlanga's atelier, or an attempt to appropriate a form from a Taifa palace, perhaps as an allusion to Alfonso's triumph in Toledo. Our problem here is rather found in the insistence on identifying the church with a kind of ethnic nomenclature, as if its vaults and horseshoe arches had to be accounted for in this late period by a remarkable kind of cultural miscegenation. I've not found a survey written outside of Spain that admits San Baudilio into the covenant of Romanesque, though most scholars in Spain accept this without question. And why not? It's a grand, entirely vaulted space built with ashlar coining, Cluniac planning, and those telltale double-soffit arches, a detail of the tendency to convert a mural aesthetic into one in which architecture articulates its rational, weight-bearing properties. This disagreement is in part possible because, unlike earlier medieval architectural categories organized according to political or temporal strategies, we characterize Romanesque as both a period and a style in indulgently overlapping categories, so that buildings can be embraced chronologically or on the basis of common aesthetic values. If we ascribe to the period as the beginning of the 11th century, it is contemporary with shifts in political economy, agriculture, and technology, with the Gregorian reforms, and with a surge of intellectual interest in antiquity. As a style in architecture, we see it as growing from the rational values of an increasingly inventive and resourceful artisanal tradition, interacting with new and varied ambitious patrons. I very much like Professor Heslop's proposition that Romanesque might be seen of as, and I'm isolating the part of his argument in which he refers to architecture, a redeployment of ancient forms in a desire to exploit a resource and organize it for the purposes of clarification, using in architecture pilasters, half columns, vaults, and diaphragm arches, a theory that musters many of the formal characterizations offered by Henri Faucillon, Eric Ferny, and Edson Army. To this, I would like to add John McNeill's remarks regarding those ancient forms, that they're persistent and geographically wide-ranging and often ideologically explicit, and yet retrospection in the Romanesque is often eclectic, partial, and highly localized. I feel that the problem lies not in any particular definition of the style or even in the selection and rejection of works that might fit into a given rubric. The problem arises instead when the limitations of a particular stylistic definition are then extended to the idea of Romanesque as a period, when a curated formal definition becomes a gatekeeper to belonging to the monumental topography of Romanesque, which is also the topography of nascent Europe. At this point, the search for what Bizzaro calls a quintessential style is a particular danger for the study of the Iberian Peninsula. This is because, strange as it may seem, we still bear the transgenerational methodological scars of the ancient artistic vision created by Emil Mahl and Arthur Kingsley Porter, who spawned the infamous Spain or Toulouse debate, channeling a fixation on relative chronology in a quest for an overarching style fostered by itinerant masons. But of course, style is negotiated and it's promiscuous, now intimately involved in practice and subconscious habits of thinking, and then in the next moment, submitting those collectively held values to the needs of patrons and other agents for transformation into conscious or symbolic meaning. So the intersection of local interests with most more wide-ranging ones can root us not only in that which is formally common in Romanesque buildings, but also in that which is particular. We do not normally require the presence of the antique in Romanesque, nor do we exclude other interlopers into its monumental liturgical space, so that one of our most interesting tasks has become, in fact, to understand those formal interlopers, those anomalies within the space of Romanesque. But there are barriers to the inclusion of certain anomalies into its canon. I am, of course, far from attempting here to rework the canon. I do wish, however, that we might begin to sweep into the fold of Romanesque a few divergent formal voices that have been excluded. We need to be careful not to suppress certain architectural expressions of a moment for the sake of constructing a myth of a single Western style. For instance, there is an entire group of churches from the 12th and 13th centuries, often excluded from the Romanesque canon by scholars both inside and out of Spain, a well-studied group of brick buildings found in Toledo, the Meseta, and New Castile, and in Aragon as well. The subject is not new. It's been the theater of operations for over a century-long battle about how to account for what's perceived as Islamic form in church building. The earliest of these buildings to survive is very likely San Eugenio in Toledo, built to receive the arm of the saint, brought to King Alfonso VII by the French monarch Louis VII himself in 1156 on his pilgrimage to Santiago de Compostela. The church is allied in style and construction to the absent crossing of Santa Cruz in the same city, the conversion of a mosque building in 1185 that we discussed at excruciating length in the first lecture in this series. In both of these buildings, broad semicircular apses are covered with a skin of bricks, divided into rows of horseshoe, keel-shaped, and polylobed arches. These forms were understood as early as the 19th century as part of an Islamic tradition that indicated the intervention of Muslims who had submitted to Christian rule. So these churches were quite early categorized as something apart, Mudéjar architecture. Mudéjar is a term, if anything, more problematic than Mozarabic as a modifier for material culture, but one that somehow has stubbornly survived, a condition to which I have perversely contributed. Please find in this lecture an attempt at redress. I'm offering myself sort of in penance today as a mediator in the troubled relationship between Romanesque and Islam. The arts that are named for this demographic group stretch across a dizzying chronological abyss from the 11th to the 17th centuries in Spain and in the New World. But here I'd like to concentrate on its use to account for brick churches of the late 11th through the 13th centuries, that is, those that overlap chronologically and typologically with Romanesque buildings in the conventional canon. Mudéjar is the name commonly given to Muslims who, without changing their religion, remained in territories ruled by Christians. And this definition sometimes includes the implication of vassalage to Christian rulers as well. Harvey cites Arabic texts that use the people who stayed on, of which the principal form is Budajin, finding it is usually used by those authors with opprobrium. It is also, he finds, there are subtle semantic links to Mudéjin, used in reference to domesticated animals, suggesting a taunt by free Muslims that grew to become a name for a status for which there was no other existing term. The abandonment of the adjective Mudéjar as regards art and architecture is now happening. And in medieval Iberia, it has in particularly been argued most convincingly by Juan Carlos Risausa and other colleagues. Compounding this etymology are the burdens to interpretation that we lay upon the arts in employing it. Mudéjar has been used to describe any example of architecture and the arts that displays a vestige of the impact of visual language that might be associated with Al-Andalus or Islamic culture conceived in the largest sense. It's used to describe carved wooden ceilings, architectural brickwork, stucco carvings, tile work and floors, painting, jewelry and armor, to explain the presence of some form of ornament that might be associated with Islamic culture. Because the term applies uniquely to Muslims, it implies the religion of the artist and by extension the artist's subordination to those who ruled the society in which the work was made. This notion of subordination came to denote, in Maria Judith Feliciano's words, the subordination of Islamic ornament to Christian structures, with the implication that ornament is robbed of its signifying power within that structure. And this implication has continued as a kind of subconscious stratum in its application today, as if Christian patrons and their projects provide a framework for containing and controlling Islamic content. Mudéjar carries with it thus the 19th century fixation with Christian identity, which transmutes in the 21st century when we tend to romanticize the dynamic plural nature of the identities on the peninsula, and I do mean we, to a kind of throbbing subconscious taxonomical anxiety to which I will return. So the use of the term stops one short interpretively. It obscures the fact that these arcades themselves are derivative of Roman brick tradition, part of a reverberation of formula between allied traditions of construction, about which the intervention of Muslims or former Muslims as possible masons does not signify one way or the other. We thus witlessly identify this particular local tradition and taste as an anomaly, grounds for an ethnic name. The term Mudéjar, in a way, provides permission to exclude these buildings from the canon of Romanesque. And so the question is, why would we want to exclude them? How some monuments on the Iberian Peninsula came to be seen as foreign to the broader project of Romanesque, when others are not, think of Sicily, is not only the fruit of 19th century historiography, it's also part of a medieval discourse. And yet our own formulations can at times fall under the spell of those ancient values, beguiling us into a kind of cultural triage of a Romanesque canon that we ourselves construct. In this terrain, it's perhaps useful to consider much of what we think of as mature Romanesque enters the Iberian Peninsula on the long arm of the monastery of Cluny and of the Reformed papacy, and is materially tagged with their explicit agendas. A circumstance that stimulated the already heightened capacity of constructional forms to signify specific identities and ideologies on the peninsula, something we saw in our discussion of 10th century architecture last week. Aragon, Navarre, and Castile in the 11th century present us with interesting sites for understanding some of the different local ways in which these interventions were located. And for this, I turn to our colleagues who work on the Iberian Peninsula. The first Christian ruler to effect something like the unification of the Christian kingdoms, albeit a short-lived one, was Sancho III of Navarre, a king the famous Abbot Oliva of Vic and Ripoy called Rey Iberico, Iberian King, a reflection of his desire to be considered the only peninsular Christian king in the first years of the 11th century, though a 14-year-old king of Leon slipped his mind. Isidro Bango, in his monumental catalog concerning Sancho the Great, describes him as possessed of a desire to participate in the same world of practices and ideas as Europe beyond the Pyrenees. In this, his mentor was Abbot Odilo of Cluny, who records that King Sancho was deemed a familiaris and member of Cluny's societas. Sancho was recruited to the project of reform to effect the conversion of local private monasteries to the Benedictine rule, beneath the more rigorous authority of bishops. By 1028, he installed a new abbot at the dramatically sited monastery of San Juan de la Peña, and famously wrote to Odilo that he wished for monks from Cluny to come to the monastery so that the community of San Juan would order their lives according to the laws and customs of those of Cluny. Sancho embarked on a program of reconstruction of monastic sites associated with his family's patronage after the cessation of destructive raids of the Umayyad rulers Al-Mansur and Abdul-Malik between 998 and 1006. In the first quarter of the 11th century, he restored the monastery of San Millán de la Cogolla, adding two bishops to its own abbot bishop, thus consolidating a restive territory. The monastery had long enjoyed his family's support, in particular that of his forebearers, the famous Queen Toda, and her son and grandson. It had been constructed a generation before, in the 10th century, as a variant of the repopulation movement we discussed before, with a single arcade of horseshoe arches accommodating awkwardly, if ardently, the site of a hermitage from the Visigothic period. But then, as we've come to expect in the 10th century, the apses were also covered with centrally planned rib vaults that might be considered Islamicate, perhaps a local interpretation of the rib vaults of Cordoba, which Queen Toda's family, in their diplomatic interactions with the Caliphate, to which they were related, might have known directly or indirectly. When Sancho the Great comes to renovate the old site, he conserves the old church, but adds two bays in a distinctive round arch style, creating, as Janice Mann emphasizes, a bold division between parts, deliberately showing the conservation of the old as well as the addition of the new. Her work shows that among all the restorations made in this period following the raids of Almansur, only a few sites sort of highlight the suture made between old and new, so explicitly drawn. Sancho wished to visualize the following, that he anchored his rule in the past, and that at the same time he wished to mark his program of monastic, ecclesiastical, and political reform. He would make a similar restoration to the monastery of San Juan de la Peña, where he adds a semicircular arched extension with transverse ribs and a cruciform pier to a 10th century church of horseshoe arched arcades, but with no attempt to obscure this fissure between the two styles. The works of Sancho, as well as those of his mentor, Abbot Oliva of Cusha, took what seems to have been seen as a French semicircular arch and vaulting style executed in local techniques and gave it meaning through a clear juxtaposition with the distinctive older local architecture, making the new early Romanesque form other to the historical indigenous one. And the meaning survived. At San Juan de la Peña, now in the late 11th century, pieces of an old horseshoe arch were reconstructed and enshrined as a portal to yet another refurbished church, bearing witness to the older church, showing a conscious and continuing association of this arch style with local history and local identity. The monarchy of Sancho the Great would splinter in that division of a kingdom among sons, which was the most cherished method of self-destruction to the northern monarchies in Spain. But what might have survived is this degree of meaning latently associated with this juxtaposition of two archetypes. This typological consciousness was not intended to be an assertion of radical alterity in these monasteries, but could rather signify both distinct temporalities and the need to mediate a local political need with a translocal aspiration. Just such an explicit juxtaposition occurs later, when Sancho's grandson, Alfonso VI, King of León and Castile, would preside over an architectural addition to a late 9th century basilica, one of those from the repopulation donated by the crown to an Andalusi community, the monastery of Saints Facundus and Primitivos at Sahagún, founded by an abbot Alfonso and his monks who came from España, from the south. José Luis Senra has revealed the two styles of the monastery church of Sahagún built between 1080 and 1100, distinct manners of building that mark another transition from an architectural policy of, in his words, local atavism to a foreign approach beneath the eyes of the Cluniac abbot, Bernard of Sedurac. The style of local atavism is a 10th century wooden roof basilica with horseshoe arched arcades and three horseshoe shaped apses reconstructed very much like the Church of San Miguel de Escalada. And the foreign approach is a massive ashlar western addition, echoing that found at the Burgundian Church of San Philibert of Tournus. A Cluniac formula responding to the needs of a reformed liturgy connected to the monastic vocation of prayer for the souls of the dead. Sahagún was thus transformed from a building that evoked a long-standing horseshoe arch tradition to one that juxtaposed that traditional paradigm to an ashlar building allied with Cluniac practice and the Roman Rite. The adjacency of these two styles became, in Senra's words, a visual metaphor for a kingdom in transition. The addition to Sahagún was used by Alfonso VI, Senra said, to unify his ambitious presence with his own dynastic past. But to those who wished to impose the new order, that juxtaposition might have signified in a divergent way. The transformation of rites at Castile was intimately allied with this shift in architectural expression. Alfonso VI found himself at the center of the Reformed papacy's attempt in the late 11th century to aggregate not only the spiritual functions of the office, but the authority of secular lordship on a feudal model as well. On the Iberian Peninsula, the existence of lands that had newly passed from Muslim to Christian hands seemed to present an opening to establish a territorial claim for the papacy, one intensified by the apocalyptic presence of Islam and other to the dominion of Christ, in whose interest the Reformed papacy staked its own terrestrial claims. Gregory VII appeared to appeal to Alfonso in 1077 that the Kingdom of Spain belonged to the Holy Roman Church as an extension of its universal authority over the kingdoms of the whole world. Alfonso's reaction to this was to defiantly name himself Emperor of all Spain, in case his claim to hegemony was unclear. A détente was established through Hugh, Abbot of Cluny, and for much of this period a papal legate and agent. Abbot Hugh engaged Alfonso in a complex dance that proposed devoted obedience to the Pope as regarded Roman liturgical reform, while sidestepping the messy issue of Iberia's mythic feudal indenture to Rome. Alfonso would thus suppress the indigenous Hispanic liturgy that the papacy and the Cluniacs held to be tainted. Gonzalez explains that for Pope Gregory, the abolition of the Mozarabic liturgy, which is another name for the Hispanic liturgy, the abolition for that liturgy was nothing more than a means for the submission of the Spanish church to Rome. One might read then in the monumental Romanesque addition to Sahagún, juxtaposed to its delicate local horseshoe arch nave, not only local atavism and reform, as Senra revealed, but also local identity and domination. For there was slippage in the smooth discourse of reform in León Castile. The liturgical changes were fraught with tension. Chronicles famously imagined a trial by combat between the two liturgies, or a trial by fire in which the Hispanic liturgy miraculously leapt from the flames, only to have King Alfonso kick it back in. In his own correspondence, Alfonso sounds beleaguered, complaining in a letter to Abbot Hugh that our realm is wholly desolated on account of the Roman office, which on your command we accepted. He asks Hugh to intervene with the Pope, lamenting the profound resistance to the Roman rite. There was a strong investment in the traditional Hispanic liturgy that cut to the heart of local identity and of an agitated indigenous clergy that resisted the changes both to their traditional rite and to the new, often foreign, superiors. I wonder if Sahagún's new monumental Western Mass might have seemed to Frankish clergy to envision a victorious Roman church overwhelming an older Hispanic one, functioning in much the same way as the voluminous apse of the Church of Santa Cruz, which seems continuously to overcome the Mosque of Ibn Hadidi. Because here, Cluny was the colonial presence. Such large Western masses appear in Cluniac institutions throughout the North, performing their capacity to make markers of papal victory on the landscape of Iberia, a meaning possible because of the way an indigenous horseshoe arch tradition signified local history and identity. Gregory VII spoke of Spain as a place polluted by early heresies and cut off from the church by invading Saracens, interactions that he claimed debilitated the Spanish church. Though the traditional justification for the attack on the Hispanic liturgy had been its corruption through contact with adoptionism, Gonzalez notes that by 1077, all references to Arians have disappeared, and the entire responsibility for liturgical irregularity is assigned to the Muslims and the pagans. Perhaps the image of one architectural language replacing another carried for the reformers a visualization of Spain's tainted past, its horseshoe arch architecture reimagined as a marker of its moral infirmity, brought on by its intimacy with Islam. These associations meant that horseshoe arches like those at Berlanga would cease to appear in new masonry churches in the 11th and 12th centuries as the project of reform spread throughout the lands newly conquered by Christian kings. The horseshoe arch was not, of course, for 11th century patrons on the Iberian Peninsula, a referent of Islam. They knew its history, its indigenous implications. Berlanga, for contemporaries of Alfonso VI at the end of the 11th century, must have signaled territorial and hegemonic dominion in typologies that were not as yet instrumentalized by the Roman Church. But as Alfonso submitted to its cultural yoke and Romanists spread throughout the peninsula, the horseshoe arch would be effectively erased. Oh, and I have to say, as we begin to talk about Haka, that I've just heard that Isidro Bango's much-awaited book has just come out, and we're waiting impatiently to read it and see how it enters our conversation. So that when we turn to such canonical buildings on the Iberian Peninsula as the cathedral at Haka, we find more familiar Romanesque typologies. Though it was the ardent project of papal reform that internationalized Iberian Romanesque, its solutions are still local and inflected by the relationship between local rulers and their ecclesiastical hierarchy, as Javier Martinez de Aguirre has shown in many studies. This can be seen in particular in the Crown of Aragon, where the interests of King Sancho Ramirez did not lie in the avocation of history. They propelled him instead into the arms of the papacy at a quite early date. He adopted the Roman liturgy, allied himself with Cluny, and promoted monastic reform, probably because his father's illegitimacy had ignominiously submitted him as a vassal to the reign of the King of Pamplona, so that he found a kind of feudal submission to Rome offered him more authority and independence. Sancho Ramirez went to Rome in 1068 at Pope Alexander II's invitation to hand himself and his kingdom over to the power of God and St. Peter. David Simon has shown that on his return from Rome, he memorialized his symbolic indenture to the papacy in a cathedral dedicated to St. Peter. The entire decorative enterprise of Haka, in Simon's words, was constructed to reflect conscious Romanization. Despite arduous attempts to find vestiges of vaulting to connect to Haka's nave response, Simon's reminds us that the building was never intended to be vaulted, but instead to evoke a particular class of antique buildings in which the wooden roof virtually serves to define form, the early Christian basilicas of Rome, and perhaps the eponymous St. Peter's. Santiago de Compostela, we now know, was begun under Diego Pelaez, beneath the shelter, in Senra's words, of the Gregorian reforms. Iconic buildings like Santiago and Toulouse can be seen as outsized platforms for connecting local ambitions with the imperial reach of the papacy. But these buildings, whose dizzying monumentality and brilliant creative figural arts place them at the center of our didactic project, are the exception rather than the rule. On the Iberian Peninsula, the negotiation of local and international interests happens intricately and intentionally, reflected in diverse manners in different places. What happens when the response to reform and expansion does not align with the values expressed at Sahagún, at Haka, or Santiago? The crossing and apse added to the Mosque of Ibn Hadidi when it became the Church of Santa Cruz in 1185 was also part of a papal agenda, as Alfonso VIII allied himself with military orders to respond to a call for crusade. And though we like to talk about horseshoe and polylobed arches as the product of an indigenous transcultural tradition of construction, here it is actually a 12th century revival of an indigenous decorative tradition. The revival of the fabrication of brick and brick building in Toledo and in those parts of Castile into which Christian rulers expanded in the 11th and 12th centuries responded, Araguas explained, to the project of reform and the need for widespread church building in newly populated areas. These were buildings constructed explicitly for the Roman liturgy. In the city of Sahagún itself, the Church of St. Tirso has compound piers, a liturgical space, and broad typologies that are the same as other wooden-roofed Romanesque churches. Yet more than one quite distinguished survey cites its Mudéjar qualifications, Arabic building technique, horseshoe-shaped arches, and very different from the Romanesque repertoire. I might have said the same thing not long ago. But today I think that San Tirso might instead be seen as marking a turn to a local Romanesque type in Sahagún, where the cut stone used in the Cluniac monastery of San Facundo y Primitivo became too costly with the waning of the city's importance. And yet its greatest taxonomical sin might really be the return of the horseshoe arch, which accompanied the resurgence of brick construction in the 12th century to serve reform in this expanding Castilian population. The occasional return of the horseshoe arch in the 12th century parochial church or in the countryside was not a problem for those in Castile's expanding country. Instead, it is for us that it has been a problem. San Tirso is sequestered from the canon of Romanesque largely for academic suspicion of collusion with Arabs or with big brick buildings like this one, San Roman in Toledo. Now here's a building to suspect, one that very few feel safe calling Romanesque. By 1221, the Church of San Roman was dedicated by Rodrigo Jimenez de Rada, Castile's indefatigable archbishop, historian, and mentor of kings, known as the ardent promoter of the crusade of Las Navas de Tolosa. Its paintings are a kind of stage set for an immediate experiential apocalypse, enframed in banded arches, Arabic and Latin epigraphy, the resurrected dead bursting from their tombs in a kind of frameless cinematic drama, tiny angels lurking in splayed windows. Let's say that again. Tiny angels lurking in splayed apse windows appear to be looking into the church from behind polylobed arches with Arabic scripts, interventions of the cosmic into the earthly consciousness of the faithful. An enormous arching apocalyptic beast is speared by an angel, explicitly evoking the words of Innocent III, who compared the Almohads to the beast of the apocalypse, declaring that Rodrigo's crusade had made their demise imminent. This and the triumphal hymns in the Latin epigraphy that Gomez told us about give San Roman a crusading iconology, and the presence of Hispanic saints together with recently canonized Cluniac Bernard of Sedirac, he of Sahagún, address an internal theme of conciliation with local Arabophone clergy. Are these competing visual agendas? In the beginning of his De Rebus Hispaniae, Rodrigo explains that the multiplication of languages in the world was a punishment Christians had to endure for the construction of the Tower of Babel, his theological justification for the world in which he was daily participating in Toledo. Multiple languages and the divergent peoples who spoke them were present by God's choice. How far are multiple languages from multiple artistic styles? And why is Rodrigo's ardent vision of unity and crusade in a basilica highlighting classical spolia, compound piers, and bay division excluded from the Romanesque canon, though somehow San Miniato al Monte, also wooden-roofed and with only one respond, is often included? But of course it has papal dispensation, and we will perhaps forgive any diversion from the ideal if it is due to an abundance of classicism. When we construct Romanesque as a European style, how do we choose and how do we exclude? Do we channel the confessional suspicions of the Reformed papacy as part of our academic definition? When we separate either of these buildings from the narrative of Western European architecture, we might be unwittingly following the papacy in Cluny in implementing a kind of cultural cleansing of a place that had become to their mind liturgically and architecturally too transculturative. Perhaps in order to find the correct place in our lexicon for buildings traditionally called Mozarabic or Mudéjar, we need to do more than simply to vanquish those problematic terms. We might also need to be sure to diversify and prod the peculiarities of more conventional Romanesque. I wonder if we might say that Iberia would be the site for the germination of several kinds of Romanesque, and that only some of these were monumental, classicizing ashlar styles, but that all of these styles were part of medieval Europe. If we turn to Romanesque buildings associated with institutions aligned with the papal cause in areas outside of the Iberian Peninsula, an echo of Islam, that other that had been so provocative and exhilarating to the early Reformed Church in Spain, was brought back from the Crusades and fetishized as a reminder of Romanesque Europe's shared identity under the Church in the face of a common foe. In places that did not have Iberia's horseshoe arch style to push back against, the alternating voussoirs of the Dome of the Rock, reinvented as the Temple of the Lord, were drawn into Clermont, where the First Crusade had been preached, and into Le Puy, from which its first leader, Adhémar of Le Puy, came, and, of course, to Vézelay, which celebrated and justified the cosmic implications of the Crusade through its thrilling tympanum. References to the Crusades bloom in the domed churches of Perigord or in the façade of Saint-Pierre at Aulnay. In fact, many in France have found it difficult to stray far from allusions to Islam, against which the Church would define its new Western Roman Empire. We ought perhaps to ask if these Romanesque buildings bristling with references to Islam within the structure of their conventional monumental classicism are anomalies. Or are they an architectural message that found its proving ground in Iberia, the territorial marker of a papacy attempting to unite Europe under its imperial insignia, providing separate polities with a common identity and a common enemy around which to congeal? This reconfigured architectural iconography returns to Spain through, and by now this should come as no surprise, the monastery of Cluny. Cluny's abbot, Peter the Venerable, traveled to Iberia during the rule of Alfonso VII in 1142 and 1143, hoping to renew the once lucrative support the Castilians had offered the abbey, as well as to contract for a translation of the Quran with which he might refute Islam, a goal fulfilled by Robert of Ketton. As support, he received the monastery of San Pedro de Cardeña. And what followed was the difficult and contested Cluniac takeover of Cardeña from its indigenous monks and its simultaneous artistic transformation. Sculptors from Auxerre and Cluny fashioned capitals of a new cloister built with robust columns bound by a ribbon of banded arches, a form unknown in Romanesque Iberia north of Toledo. Burgundian masons were induced to introduce it here as a way of binding the project of crusade in the Holy Land with that of Hispania. These alternating voussoirs only carry a vague whiff of that which bound Cordoba to Jerusalem. They were now a French motif, mustering a bipolar opposition to Islam, promoted in fabricated martyrdoms. It was here also that Cluny reinvented Rodrigo Diez de Vivar as El Cid, a sanctified warrior in the fight against a reductive Islam. And they did it already in the 11th century, although his 18th century mounted figure in the monastery's facade is called, in Cardeña's monastic literature, a Cid Matamoros, Cid the Moor Killer, the bodies of Muslims beneath his horse's hooves. It's a far-off echo of the 12th century militarization of St. James as Santiago Matamoros, embraced here in the 17th century in the red and white language of architectural détournement. By the 12th century, indeed, the Church had learned to redeploy forms once resisted. Both the conscious and ambivalent meanings of the chapel of Santa Cruz in Toledo, for instance, would travel. At the church of San Sepulcro in Torres del Rio, the ribbed vault from the little Toledo mosque that once referenced Cordoba is redeployed in a tiny replica of the Holy Sepulchre and became the model for other churches in Iberia and France dedicated to the Holy Cross, as the church of Santa Cruz was. This is all pointed out by Martinez de Aguirre. Torres del Rio holds in its form both a reference to the crusading activities of the Hospitallers to the Holy Land, and then also an evocation of the immediate and palpable presence of Islam and crusade on the peninsula. What was too exotic and indigenous at Berlanga is now appropriated and tamed in Ashlar, reinvented to serve an Iberian crusading project. But of the two buildings, Berlanga and Torres del Rio, only the second, its ideological instrumentalization of exotic form carefully defined, only the second is admitted to us in the canon of Romanesque. Karen Armstrong remarks that the first collective act of the body we now think of as Europe was the First Crusade, called by Gregory's successor, Cluniac Urban II, in 1095. Nothing, Dennis Hayes opines, did more to compel a specifically territorial view of Christianity than opposition to Islam. It was, in fact, in the reign of Gregory VII that the word Christendom would first take on a territorial identification with Europe. Fines Christianitatis, the boundaries of Christendom, became the limits of the West. The West, Anders Stephenson reminds us, has even today become not so much a place as one side of a dualism. William of Malmesbury recalled Urban II cautioning Europe that it was threatened by Saracens and Turks. 300 years ago, they conquered Spain, and now they hope to conquer the rest of Europe too. Thus, the great reforming popes and one or two politicians today marked the unification of Europe in a world aligned against a mythic, reductive Islam. The question is, do we wish to accept the papacy's West as our West, the papacy's Romanesque as our Romanesque? We know that the medieval West, like the West today, was richer and much more complicated than that. Thank you.